Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, a pet wellness advocate with a special interest in dog and cat nutrition. I wrote the Dog Bible and the Cat Bible, but I'm still learning every day about what goes into a good, healthy diet for our pets. I'm here with pet food experts to help unravel the mysteries of pet diets so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own cats and dogs. If you want to stay in the know when it comes to doing what's best for your pets, follow me on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find me at Tracy Hotchner. That's Tracy with an I-E. Have a pet-related question or comment? Post it on my page or tweet me. Pet Food Advisors is a production of Pet Media, Inc., with opinions and information that are the sole responsibility of the expert guests who offer them. I also produce the philanthropic New York Dog Film Festival, sponsored by the Petco Foundation, which I take around the country, celebrating the love between dogs and their people while benefiting the animal welfare groups that bring them together. Get more information at dogfilmfestival.com and the new catfilmfestival.com. This show is brought to you in part with the generous support of Precious Cat Litter, owned by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian who has created a variety of low-dust litters for the health of all members of the family, so everyone can breathe easier. Precious Cat has a litter for the special needs of kittens, for senior cats, for long-haired, and for those with out-of-litter box problems, who can get back in the box with Cat Attract litter. Precious Cat's Touch of the Outdoors is a litter made with field grasses grown in their own fields, bringing the natural scent of the outdoors to provide environmental enrichment for indoor cats. Precious Cat's newest health monitor litter has broken new ground by allowing people to find the early signs of kidney disease in their kitties and intervene before damage is done, prolonging the quality and length of their kitty cat's lives. I'm here today to discuss something which I actually had never thought about much, but now has come onto my radar, which is what happens when there's a pet food problem with canned food. Everyone kind of knows about bagged food, but what if somehow some canned pet food is implicated, a finger is pointed? What is the whole system that gets set in motion to find out if there's something wrong, and if so, what do you do about it? So I turned to the Pet Food Institute, which is a member organization, and the members are 98% of the United States pet food and treat company makers. So it's an industry group that represents them, that guides them, that stands up for them. And I turned to their communication director, Mary Emma Young, grabbed her first thing in the morning as soon as this hit my brain. So she's there with her two dogs, Maddie and Pepper, in Washington, D.C. And good morning, Mary Emma. I hope you've had your coffee because I'm about to ask you all kinds of questions.
Good morning, Tracy. And I am caffeinated and ready to go with two dogs at my feet who will hopefully stay asleep for this.
Excellent. And if not, if they have any comments, I'm sure they are appropriate. So we know about the scary pet food recall that happened so many years ago, and it was around bagged food, much of which was made by the same sort of packing facilities and involved a confusing array of things that may have caused a confusing array of physical ailments in dogs and cats. So now it's come to my attention that there is a canned food happens to be made in a human food facility, but that's somewhat irrelevant because there are cat and kitten owners in Australia saying, oh, I fed this food, and my cat's sick and my cat died, and all kinds of different symptoms. And then a lot of question mark about, well, what would happen in the U.S. if a finger was pointed? And let's say the ball starts rolling and social media being what it is, It can snowball, let's just say that. A ball starts rolling and can snowball. And who jumps on the bandwagon and why? So I want to know, let's say in America, three people or one person calls up a pet store, pet food store, assuming they didn't buy it online, and says, oh, I fed my cat this food and it got sick, it threw up. Well, what does the Pet Food Institute say? Is there a kind of a set of guidelines about what a store should do before anything else? Is the store, in the old days of brick-and-mortar stores, totally predominated? Is that the first line of defense, so to speak? Or what is seen by the Pet Food Institute as the way to handle a finger pointing, which may or may not be correct. Nobody wants animals to get sick. Mm-hmm. No company wants their mm-hmm. food to have a problem. No one's trying to hide anything. On the other hand, you don't want mass hysteria. So what is supposed to happen?
Thank you for asking that. That's a great question. And I thought maybe before we dive into that, I can talk a little bit about what a pet food recall is and what it means.
Excellent.
And as a pet owner, obviously it's very worrisome. And steps that you can take as a pet owner if you think that you own one of the products or that your pet is ill or has some kind of symptoms that you believe may be associated with that food. First, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about what a pet food recall means. And as pet owners, obviously, we can get a little anxious when we hear that, and that's totally understandable. And the fact is that recalls are an integral part to our food safety system, and that includes pet food. So the Pet Food Institute, our members make about 98% of U.S. pet food and treats, and their number one priority is the production of safe, nutritious food.
Yep.
This means that throughout the manufacturing process for pet food, there is regular testing throughout the process, from incoming ingredients to finished product, including canned and bagged food. This testing will be done by the pet food company themselves, and they'll also contract third-party labs for testing. These are businesses that are, you know, trusted suppliers, goods and service providers that the members use. So just to give you a quick sense of some of the monitoring that will go on throughout the manufacturing process, that can include looking for harmful bacteria such as salmonella, contaminants such as mycotoxins, which occur naturally in the grain of a farmer's field, or physical hazards like stones or metal that could unintentionally be introduced somewhere along the way.
So let me just mm-hmm. ask a question about those third-party yeah. labs. Important yeah. for, I think, people to understand, which I know mm-hmm. about because when Balance It was coming out with a very special and fancy, sort of more of a vet type of a food, and they had mm-hmm. to send for testing while developing the food to make sure that mm-hmm. it had the right protein levels, to make sure that it had the mm-hmm. right vitamin and mineral levels. Each test was thousands of dollars. This is not a minor expense and not something done frivolously and not something done to cover anything up. It's to expose it in all openness, right,
exactly.
and to correct the
exactly.
problem. So important to
exactly.
understand that. And those labs, it's sort of like the state emission tests for cars. Back in the day before computers and stuff, and I lived in L.A., you could pay – I didn't personally do it – but you could pay off to have your emissions test come out clean. It's not like that. First of all, it's not like that anymore because it goes mm-hmm. to a computer, and you can't lie if you have, you know, too much ugly stuff coming out of your muffler. But in the same way,
yeah.
the labs are not there to cover anything up. I think that's an important thing to point out because there is an unfortunate level of suspicion around pet food by consumers, mm-hmm. I'd like to discuss separately, because I must say it baffles me. It disturbs and saddens and baffles me. But just to say, yes, so the third-party testing goes on during production or creation of a new food, right?
Yes, exactly. And I'll go into a little bit further down the line, additional roles that a third-party lab may play, because you know, throughout the monitoring, throughout the process, should there be a moment where a test result comes back out of specification of that company's food safety plan, or let's say something is raised by a regulator through the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or, and I'll touch on this later, instances of calls or concerns from consumers.
Right.
If a company decides they need to act on that, they will work internally rapidly and with regulators to remove the product from the shelf as quickly as possible. And that's the role of the recall.
So and is a recall the, something that is imposed on a company or something that a company does willingly and says out loud because it's just ethical and moral, or is there some legal obligation, if you will?
Yes, so that's a very good question. And under federal law, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration can ask or mandate, there's a statute that will force a company to pull a product from shelves if needed. However, to to my knowledge, every pet food recall, at least in many recent years, has been voluntary. That has been either through ways in which that issue has been flagged at that company, and that has been voluntarily removed from market. But, you know, under the Food Safety Modernization Act, FSMA, which is a major food safety law that impacts pet food makers as well, there is the ability of the federal government to mandate a removal. But to my knowledge, it's all been voluntary so in many recent years.
So the phrase pet food recall could refer to something as simple as 10 cans or 10 bags that somehow got contaminated in shipping all the way to an entire line of food, right? It could be anything at all that's pulled off the shelf. Okay.
Yes.
That's the manufacturer who may have heard about a potential problem directly from consumers or from a store that itself has heard from consumers, right?
Yes. And so that ties into what I think we can talk about now, which is if a pet owner has a concern about, you know, potentially their pet being impacted by a food, some steps that they can take right away. First, I recommend that you, as the pet owner, view the label on the package and note down any lot or batch number. It's the small numbers printed somewhere on the bag. Because as
we're talking about canned food now, because I mean, bagged food is a very different situation. No, it's fine, but I mean, I think it's important because canning is such a different process, and the likelihood of it going off or going bad, other than you have a bulging can suggesting botulism, I would think is lower with canned products.
No, so thank you. Sorry, I'm using the term bag, and I should be saying can here, but I recommend the pet owner look for that lot or batch number. Because that's how companies are able to carefully track when and where that product was canned and to be able to trace it back as effectively as possible. So I recommend that the pet owner keep an eye on that lot and batch number and call the manufacturer and report that information to the manufacturer. Because, again, that helps them efficiently track that down. In addition, I recommend that the other step is to take your pet to the veterinarian. The FDA has a program wherein they are receiving reports from veterinarians related if a veterinarian believes that there's an illness or symptoms that could be related to food. And so that is information that can be shared between veterinarians and FDA. So I recommend that you also take your pet to the veterinarian and provide that information to the veterinarian as well.
Let me just interrupt for 1 minute. In the process of the vet examining this pet, and maybe the pet has something which veterinarians refer to as, what do they call it? Oh, ADR, ain't doing right. That is actually a phrase used by all vets when an animal comes in just off, has stopped eating or drinking in a normal way, is somewhat lethargic, just ain't doing right. But if it goes beyond that, if there's some symptom that's more dramatic than that, does the vet have to go out of their way to make this report to the FDA? In other words, how much is dependent on the individuals in the chain of information to make it more public? Mm-hmm. Because Australia is obviously a completely different country and system. Legally, they're on the parliamentary British system. How their food safety and so forth works, I don't know. So we can only speak to America.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But the question of the idea that a Center for Disease Control or an FDA gets involved so it's not just whisper and rumor, and the information was hard to gather in Australia. There didn't seem to be a centralized place that the vets or the consumers could contact. But in the U.S., when a vet has this concern about a food, is it their first reaction is, do they have an 800 number that they call?
Well, there is a main website through FDA where you can go and report a particular issue. And I think that that's something that if a pet owner is taking their pet to the vet with some specific concerns, that's something you should be raising with the veterinarian. Because that's a way to keep track of what symptoms veterinarians should be looking out for, for example. And again, that helps FDA also stay abreast of what's going out there on the field.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but I know there's a lot of fine points that are very interesting to learn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My last step is recommending that returning the product to the pet store or where you purchase that food. As mentioned, as you were talking about, a major step here is keeping that chain of communication open. And that includes the communication between the pet store and the manufacturer, or the pet food store and the manufacturer.
So that's part of a pet food store's idea of how to run a good business. If there's complaints about any product, a toy or a food or a treat, they get in touch with the manufacturer and say, we've had this return, there was a problem.
I think the step's really up to the store to decide how to handle it, but I personally believe a solid level of communication is a very important step here.
So in terms of cause and effect, to kind of talk in a more generalized way about illness, we remember in Chicago, particularly in Chicago, I think it's about 2 years ago, an unheard of, never before seen canine flu hit parts of the country, but in particular Chicago. The dogs had a number of symptoms. They were very, very sick. It was highly contagious. In the beginning, nobody knew what it was. So had those first 8, 10, 12, 20 dogs gone to the vet and happened to have all eaten the same food, and each of them said, I don't know, he was fine yesterday and he only ate his crunchy munchies, that could be seen as a red herring as being the cause of these random dogs' illness. It was only realized within not a very long amount of time that it was a highly contagious, I believe it was an avian flu that had gone across species and was,
I remember that, yeah,
and could be fatal. And our Center for Disease Control got involved because anything that could be zoonotic that could pass from other animals to humans is of concern. It was a big deal. And a test was immediately created by IDEX, which was pretty brilliant. And then Mariel or somebody, or maybe IDEX, I don't remember, came out with a vaccine against it. It was a brilliant response. But if you have a situation, in this case, it was cats and kittens eating a canned food, and kittens in particular are vulnerable to so many kitten diseases, infectious diseases, viruses, bacteriological, and so forth, the presumption that what they had in common, one of the things they had in common, was eating a particular food. Is there a danger in that, or is there really no way around it? You have to eliminate the food as a possible culprit. Is that something that the pet food industry is aware of as a possible finger being pointed inappropriately?
Well, you hit an interesting point, because food is a common denominator in many of these instances. When a person is sick, or when a pet is sick, which is always a tragic instance, food is a common denominator, and that's going to be something where, of course, people are going to want to look at right away. And it's something that's controllable as well, in the sense of I can change the diet, for example. And so, you know, we recognize that. And again, that's where I strongly believe that taking your pet to the veterinarian is going to be a really important step here, because the veterinarian is going to be one of the critical factors in determining the root cause of whatever is making the pet sick. And if you just, let's say it's not the diet, but switching the diet is the first step, that's not necessarily going to be what's treating and helping the pet in the long run. And my recommendation, always, when I talk to friends, my friends at the dog park get so sick of hearing me, you know, talk about everything pet food.
I can imagine. People get sick of me too.
Take your pet to the vet, and it could be a number of factors, food, the diet. Yes, that could be one of the factors. And, you know, let's work together to further target and nail this down.
I guess having been a volunteer EMT and driver with the East Hampton Ambulance for 8 years, there were people.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a fantastic part of my life there, and was very rewarding, satisfying, challenging, and educational. There were often people with severe digestive problems who would call 911. They were that sick. And they would say, I just ate at and name one of the top five restaurants in the Hamptons. This has to be food poisoning. And, you know, if they claimed it could be the steak or the hamburger or the tuna tartare. But in fact, the timing was such that what we know about human food poisoning and illness, it didn't make sense. But they wanted to blame that restaurant. And people get stomach bugs all the time. And was it the food? Or was it somebody's unclean hands? Who can say? But if nobody else reported it, and often we hear of these situations where 4 or 6 people eat at a restaurant together and all shared a bite of this or that. And I don't know what people later think. Could the one bite have had some bacteria in it because nobody else got sick? But again, this presumption, well, it must have been what I ate, when in fact there's other things that can make somebody sick, including gallbladder attacks and other things, pancreatitis, whatever it might be, you know, diverticulitis. But the presumption that it's what you ate, as you say, it's sort of like the first thing to think of. But it doesn't necessarily help solve a problem. And where pet food's concerned, particularly canned food, you have to sort of wonder what could be in or what could have been left out of a cat food that could make animals so sick that they're hospitalized, that in some cases they report deaths. When this food in question was checked apparently for the possibility of heavy metals and mercury, because they were fish-based foods, as so many canned cat foods are. And had those mercury levels been really high and had those cats and kittens been fed only that food from maybe only that batch for a long time, in theory, that could have caused maybe some neurological symptoms, some of which had what seemed to be vestibular disease, shaky, wobbly, falling over, which can be many other things as well. There was nothing wrong with those levels in this food. And yet cats, or it was reported by some owners in a huge country, Australia, right? So I don't even know what the geography was. But I think that there's a very good lesson for all of us in this, which is what else would a company test for? They're obviously going to keep testing until they get a completely, quote unquote, clean bill of health. So it didn't have the high mercury or heavy metals that could have happened because maybe one load of fish had higher in its body. You can't really necessarily control for that. But these third-party labs that would test food during its production process, would they be the same ones to which a pet food company would turn to test? I knew those dogs were going to say something. Hi, Maddie. Hi, Pepper.
Sorry.
Good dogs. They're like,
Maddie's
yes.
Maddie's a good guard dog.
Good girl. So what are those labs? Are they the same ones or different ones that you would then go to and say, well, first of all, the question is, what does a food company say to the lab? Well, okay, you've removed question mark A. Who determines what else could be tested for? Is it the lab? Is it their experts who say, okay, we have a checklist we're going to check for low this vitamin, or what about the taurine, which has to be in all cat foods? Is there too much? Is there too little? Is there a checklist where cat food's concerned? Or does that have to be the let's say, the ones who came up with the so-called recipe or the ingredient deck for the company? Would they be the ones to say, you better check these three things?
Yeah, and that's a good question. To my knowledge, and the best to which I can speak to it right now, is that it's really going to come down to that specific situation, looking at the specific symptoms that are being reported and thinking about what could be playing a role in causing those symptoms. And it's going to vary situation to situation and company to company. Now, I would note that one of the things you mentioned, for example, was testing and assuring the nutritional balance, because there are essential vitamins and minerals, and for cats, they are different than for dogs, such as the essential role of taurine. And so it might, one of the things, as you mentioned, yes, it could be another analysis of the nutrient levels found in that pet food to make sure that the nutrient level is balanced and that perhaps there wasn't a, you know, differentiation there as well. It's also going to be, I'd imagine, taking a look at what under federal law, companies have to have a look at what the potential hazards could be throughout the manufacturing process. So, for example, I talked about the presence of, let's say, a physical object. So let's say the food was being transported at some point in a truck, and a small piece of metal from the truck could have found its way in there. The company needs to monitor what those potential hazards could be and take steps to mitigate those hazards in advance. So I imagine the companies would also be taking a look at their hazard analysis and another look at what some of those potential hazards along the way could be playing a role. But But I do think it will vary company by company and by lab to lab based on the symptoms, the potential hazards that could be playing a role that the company will have mitigated before in advance. You know, those are the steps I imagine they'll be taking.
So who would the big daddy doctor be? Because not all pet food companies have a veterinary, certainly not a board-certified veterinary nutritionist aligned with them, because there's so few of them. The very big companies certainly do. But smaller companies, private companies, or even the big ones, who would be the vet who would say, okay, we have this bunch of symptoms. Some are neurological. Some are gastrointestinal. Obviously, one would think different possible problems could cause those two very different things to happen. Who is the – is it a big daddy doctor vet, as in the FDA – maybe, but I don't think so in this case, who says that symptom, the very first thing I'd look for is A, then B, then C, and at that point it can't be the food kind of thing. Is there someone who has that kind of a overarching knowledge and authority to help to jump in? Because otherwise, isn't a pet food company a bit in the dark? So seven kittens were vomiting, and one had seizures, and the other one was wobbly, and they live in different areas and they're different ages, and were they feral kittens, and what else were they exposed to, and had they been vaccinated, and so forth and so on, you know?
Yeah. And I imagine that for the organizations that don't necessarily have this in-house expertise, I would imagine that they are contracting some third-party experts to assist, and especially on an emergency case as needed.
So they would go out and reach out to a veterinarian who is knowledgeable in this area, has dealt with these things before, they hope, and just get guidelines from that doctor. What should we be testing for? And then they go to the third-party lab and say, test for X. Now, then the question is – sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go.
Well, why would it take more than a week to test for something? How do we know what it is that labs can test for? I mean, we certainly don't know that a mercury or a heavy metal test could come back quickly, but apparently it can. I would guess something like a salmonella, or which I don't think grows in canned food, but in dry food. Botulism's in a can, but the can is almost exploding if it has botulism. I mean, it's not a secret, right? I mean, people have been canning foods for generations, and canned food is one of the safest ways to eat any food. And if the can is in any way dented or bulging, you don't eat it because of the potential of botulism, as I understand it. But this clearly was not part of the situation. So why would it take a week to – what could possibly be tested for that would take a week or 2 weeks to find out?
Yeah, I imagine that for something taking a longer amount of time, it's, as we had discussed, really narrowing down and narrowing the target further and further. And I imagine one other step they might be doing, or a company may be doing in such a situation, is also taking some closer scrutiny across the supply chain, looking at some of what those other potential hazards could have been playing a role in this situation. And again, just really narrowing the target more and more.
And what about the tests on the cats or the dogs, depending on the situation? Is there some sort of, in America with the Pet Food Institute, does it have guidelines to say if you have, as soon as there's a suspicion of an animal that appears to be sickened by food, you should get this blood test or this tissue sample or this ultrasound? Is there a list of things that a vet would have as a checklist, or are these just common sense to a veterinarian?
I imagine it's sort of basic steps that a veterinarian would know to look for. And I'd also, again, recommend, if you think that this could be related to a specific product or recall, is also contact that company as well. I'll tell you, our member companies, they are here to serve as that information source, particularly related to a recall. And they want to provide the information that will help pet owners keep their pets safe. So if there might, for example, be a particular recall going on a product and you are concerned, and one of the steps is calling that manufacturer as well.
What about if there's any trouble reaching a manufacturer or you want to be more efficient? Is the Pet Food Institute someplace that one can call, or it's more that FDA online reporting system?
I'd recommend the FDA online reporting as well.
So what about pets who've died?
This is
a situation that has come up in the past, whether it's with things that wind up being an influenza outbreak or some more isolated situation. And when any of our pets dies unexpectedly from an illness, I've been through it, many of us have been through it, and it often happens with things like cancer. Cancer, which doesn't really express itself, it happened with my Teddy, and 6 days later, and in the emergency hospital, and had he eaten a certain food, I'd be thrilled to have pointed that finger because that dog was so sick. It would have been great to know what it was and be able to solve it that way. But it was liver cancer, and in dogs at least, these cancers can be there for quite a long time. And when the symptoms happen, they're very close to death. So in that case, and I know people who've had animals just die in a day or two, and they weren't necessarily blaming a pet food, but they couldn't believe it. And so they had a necropsy done, an autopsy on their dead animal. And I'm wondering how much you at the Pet Food Institute know about whether that's valuable. Is it instructional to the person whose pet has died or to the greater community? Is there a value in doing that?
I mean, it's a sad subject to talk about, obviously. One sick pet is one too many. And so when we're talking about something really tragic, such as a pet dying, it's a hard call. And I think it really, again, to say it varies based on the situation and, if it's something your veterinarian may be recommending you do, or contacted, let's say, the manufacturer or FDA, and that could have been a step discussed or involved as well. And you know, it's hard, particularly with the death of a pet. And that's where I really think keeping that open channel of communication going to learn what recommendations might be on next steps there.
And I guess that goes back to the topic of open communication.
Yeah.
And a company being as transparent as possible. On the one hand, they have to also protect their company, their brand. And what if it wasn't their food? So they don't want to go mea culpa, you know, it's all on us because, of course, until it is all on them with proven tests, it isn't on them. And as soon as the finger's pointed, you have brand damage, company damage that's done maybe forever, but certainly short term. So in terms of business, that's a fine line to walk also, right? I mean, you have to protect your company and wanting to protect pets. I guess one of the things that disturbs me, it seems to be very much in the social media noise in Australia, but it's very prevalent in America. And I don't know, as the communications director and spokesperson for PFI, how politically correctly you can speak to this, but I'm dismayed by the assumption of so many American pet owners that somehow pet food companies are the enemy, that they're out to just make a buck with any lousy thing that's put in a bag or a can, make a buck on the backs of our pets, and they don't care. And I am just astonished at where does that hostility and that presumption come from. I think it is completely misguided. All companies are making products as well as they can, whether it's, you know, people making potato chips or pet food or bread or whatever it may be, and they obviously need to make some profit to be a business that stays alive. But their intention would never be to fob off on somebody some horrible ingredient, which is some idea that's kind of grown up in America around the pet food industry. And I think that plays into this presumption of guilt and anger and finger pointing, is this kind of underlying, I just can't wait to express my hostility. Is that something that you guys speak about quietly behind closed doors?
Well, I'll tell you that there are some very passionate feelings about pets and what we feed our pets. And I'll talk about two reasons that I think are playing a role in some of these discussions that are going on. First, I would say, is the continued role that social media plays in our lives. We find like-minded people very easily on the internet and are able to talk and communicate with them, share information, some of which may be accurate, some of which may be not. To quote the off-trendy term, fake news.
Right.
And that continues, I think, to build us into these silos of thinking and of how we view the world. And with that, I think another role is that as, you know, many years ago, a decade ago, people became much more hyper-conscious about what they are eating and what's going into their body. We are seeing that same mentality and how we think about our pets now. I think it's a growing interest, certainly across the U.S., and I imagine in many other countries across the world, in our pet diets as well, and wanting, obviously, the best health possible for your pets. And just as many years ago, we started to think more and more about our food that we're feeding ourselves as humans, we're now seeing much more of that discussion on what we're feeding our pets as well, which I believe is also shaping some of that role. And, you know, when I hear comments such as that these companies are in it to make a buck, things like that, it shocks me because these companies,
yes, me too.
Yeah, they are dedicated to pets. And, you know, we've been able to learn a little bit more about some of their activities. And first off, I would say the pet ownership rate within our member companies is higher than the national average, certainly higher than the national average. More people at these companies have pets than what you'll find on the street. And they are whether it's through building parks, donating food or money to shelters or emergency relief efforts. I mean, it's tens of millions of pounds of food being donated a year to these kind of efforts. And in the way they talk, in their offices, in their pet-friendly policies, you see the proof that they really care about these pets. And they're in it to help pets live a long and healthy life. And so it always shocks me to, you know, hear this commentary that it's, you know, in it for a buck.
It does me too. And when I was first researching the Dog Bible, I got caught up in some of that noise. And it was before Facebook, before social media, but there was still a kind of, there were still publications you could read. I don't think they were even online yet, to be frank. It actually used the mail. People used to mail newsletters.
Wow.
Can you imagine? I know. And magazine articles. I don't know. I mean, snail mail. And I mean, a whole generation that's like, huh? Snails? and it's easy to get caught up in it. Oh, my God, they put what in the pet food? And what I've learned and my own, if you will, I've become abashed by the fact that I got caught up in that because it feels so righteous and the indignation is so rewarding. But honestly, to make a pet food at a certain price point, which is what I've come to understand, in order to make pet foods that are affordable to those for whom a higher price point would be daunting, would keep them from having a pet or more pets, it has to have ingredients that are economically correct. You get the same amount of a balance of proteins and vitamins and minerals, and pet food recalls or questions like this bring up the fact that that balance does matter. We all know that cats will die without the right amount of taurine, which comes naturally in a mouse and not in much else. But other vitamin mineral balances, you know, calcium and fats and so forth, matter for heart health and brain and neurological and so forth. So all of that that goes into a lower price point food is lower price point so that the people that can only afford that, that's what they can afford. But one wouldn't should not bash that company for having put, for example, corn in it. Now, there was a moment in time where everybody was pointing the finger at corn, and there were some documentaries made about, oh, God, there's all this high fructose corn syrup in human food, and it's killing us. Killing us. I think what's curious to me is this indignation about pet food. Well, guys, they have to make a buck. It's a product. It costs money to make. But the people at each of those companies, the ones that are making a more, just be honest, a more corn-based, lower price, supermarket brand type of food, they have the exact same amount of dedication, devotion, believing they're making a really good product for the price.
Yeah.
And then there's premium, and then there's super premium, each of which removes certain items and replaces them with quail and duck and rabbit, and good for them. And for people who go, oh, I must feed my dog duck and rabbit and only quinoa, it's mm-hmm. great, but it comes at a very high price because duck and quinoa costs a lot of money. So mm-hmm. I think there's a willful misunderstanding about that, both the intention of a pet food company and what goes into a food to make it a certain price point. But the thing that isn't logical is that the human food companies making fast food, which any nutritionist, any social documentarian will tell you, has become the downfall of the health of American humans. Eating fast food, chemical-laden, mm-hmm. and whatever the underlying ingredients are, but particularly chemical-laden to make it, let's call it nearly addictive, mm-hmm. surprisingly repetitive and tasty, delicious with loads of things in it, be it chemicals or certain kinds of fats and other ingredients that have made us and our children morbidly obese and at terrible risk for horrible illness and low quality of life. Nobody is saying, how dare they? How dare they make a whole dinner that only costs $2.50 when you know that's a ridiculously low amount of money for drinks and fries and a sandwich and a cookie, all of which are probably not things that belong in your body, certainly not on a regular basis. I mean, eat a bowl of oatmeal. You know, I mean, this is the strange thing, is that people have no moral indignation against those companies mm-hmm. getting children, if you will, quote unquote, hooked on eating little fried bites of some mysterious ingredients, which taste so yummy that it's the only thing the kids will eat. And these kids don't look like what children looked like 10 years ago, certainly not 20 years ago. They're fat. They're really fat. And they also have mood disorders and they have attention disorders. And how much of that has to do with these fast foods for humans? There's certainly an implication, let's put it that way. Nobody is morally indignant about that. Well, Michael Moore is. He makes a great movie, you know, Super Size Me. Or he may not even have made that movie. Whoever made Super Size Me was
Morgan
an amazing
Farlock.
Movie. And that, thank you. Exactly. Yeah. And then there's the one that was made about the dairy industry, which was fascinating. But, you know, the tiny 1% of 1% of food nuts sees those and goes, wow, that's terrible. All of the pet owners have this kind of chip on their shoulder. Most of them have this chip like, yeah, what are you trying to foist off in that bag or in that can to our pets? There's no foisting. It says right on it what's in it. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's part of the jumping to an angry conclusion. I don't know, but it's disturbing because it doesn't do anybody any good.
Yeah. What I like to recommend to folks, particularly who are trying to pick the best food for their pet, is I want folks to not feel guilty about what they're feeding their pet. I want guilt-free pet ownership, particularly when it comes
good.
To their diet. And so my recommendation to be guilt-free and to still support your pet's health, my recommendation is to make sure it's a complete and balanced diet. As you said, the nutrition is such a critical component here, you know, for example, with cats, and they have different nutritional needs. And so look for something that's complete and balanced diet, and for that right life stage, kittens are very, you know, they're growing, and they have different needs than adult and fully mature cats. So pick complete and balanced for the right life stage. And then my recommendation is pick what makes you feel good and that you can afford and that your pet likes. And, you know, we want you to feed your pet guilt-free, knowing that you can still give them the full nutrition they need.
That's well said. Guilt-free, and if a problem arises, let's all work together with the mm-hmm. presumption that nobody wants sick pets.
Yeah.
Nobody wants that to happen on either side of the aisle. So let's try and think of working together in unity on behalf of these animals and their wellness, and to keep companies strong and safe, to keep making good, decent, safe, clean foods that, mm-hmm. as you say, each person's going to choose the thing that makes them feel the best and that they can afford the best. Mary Emma Young, you are great. The Pet Food Institute is there to educate and to support and to help through crises as well as through good times. So yeah. I hope that everyone can take away some good advice from this. certainly this is a time when your vet is a really important, crucial part of figuring out if your pet should get ill, not only what is causing it, but how to arrest the problem and get that pet back on a healthy track as soon as possible. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you so much, Mary Emma Young and the Pet Food Institute.
Thanks, it was great talking to you.
This show has also been supported by Best Pet RX, a unique compounding pharmacy for pets in New York City. They can turn any medication for dogs and cats into a custom-flavored, oral paste, chewable tablet, or a liquid that your pet will actually like. And Best Pet RX will keep trying formulations at no extra charge and offers same-day delivery in New York City and overnight delivery anywhere else so that your pet can happily take the medication she needs to get well and stay well. Support for this show also comes from VaxaCheck, a simple test done right in your vet's office to discover whether your dog or puppy is protected from the deadly core diseases or needs revaccination. If you're concerned about over-vaccinating your pet, whether young or old, VaxaCheck can help you and your veterinarian make the best decision about vaccinating in your individual situation. Shelters can use VaxaCheck on new arrivals to separate healthy dogs from unprotected ones and avoid unnecessarily over-vaccinating dogs. VaxaCheck, for your dog's safety and your peace of mind.